Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear argument for petitioner in Crane v. San Jacinto State.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael O'Connor will present argument for petitioner.
May it please the court, my name is Michael O'Connor. I'm the attorney for the petitioner, Mr. Ray Crane. This case involves a usury charging violation and a motion for judgment. And I believe that the primary issue in this case is whether motion can constitute a vehicle for a usury charging violation. Now, if this court has already accepted the proposition that pleadings can be the basis for a usury charging violation, which seems to be apparent from the majority opinion in the Danziger case, then this court should have little difficulty in determining that a motion should also be a vehicle for a charging violation, because although there may be distinctions between motions and pleadings in various areas, they certainly both represent a demand, an application, or a petition to the court to render a judgment. And if that application or petition or whatever contains an excessive amount of interest, then it should be a basis for usury. However, because of Justice Gonzalez's concurring opinion in Danziger, I am not absolutely sure that this court won't be looking at the entire premise of whether or not pleadings as well as motions or anything in a lawsuit per se can be a vehicle for a charging violation. In retort to the question about charging in a lawsuit, I would point out that Texas law has recognized a number of instances outside of the usury area in which creditors may be penalized for actions that they take in the litigation area. One example of this is in the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, which is Section 22 of the Laundry List Violation, in Section 1746, which prohibits a creditor from filing suit on a note in a county other than the debtor's residence or where the note was signed. Under the Texas Debt Collection Practices Act, Article 5069, 11.05, subsection G, that section prohibits a creditor from misrepresenting the status of a debt in any judicial proceeding, and a violation of the Texas Debt Collection Practices Act may also be a Deceptive Trade Practices Act. Third, in the garnishment area, garnishments require that you submit affidavits in support of your garnishment, and a wrongful garnishment, including punitive damages, may be based upon false statements in the affidavits submitted to the court. And finally, this court in Ingham versus Harrison at 224 Southwestern 2nd 1019 held that a creditor may be denied prejudgment interest in attorney's fees, which he would otherwise be entitled to, if the creditor has sued for an excessive amount. Secondly, I would point out that the issue of charging usurious interest in lawsuits has been faced by courts of other states, which have held that suing for too much interest in a lawsuit is a charging violation under their usury laws. This has occurred in Georgia, and the Supreme Court decision of Bell versus Luzier of Albany, Inc. at 229 Southeastern 2nd 374. In Pennsylvania, the case of Monroe Loan Society of Pennsylvania versus Morello at 51 Atlantic 2nd 347. And also the Lackawanna Thrift and Loan Corporation versus Kabachnik at 20 Atlantic 2nd 903. And finally, in New Jersey, at 147 Atlantic 2nd 401, in the case of Consolidated Plan of New Jersey versus Shanholtz. All of these cases have held that it is a usury charging violation for the creditor to demand an excessive amount of interest or an illegal fee in the lawsuit itself. There are a bunch of cases, of course, which have held that if you make a demand before the lawsuit, but I have picked out the cases which have focused upon the very issue faced by this court, that is, actually suing for or taking some action in a lawsuit to demand an excessive amount of interest or an illegal fee. And all of these cases hold that that is a usury charging violation under those state statutes. Next, on public policy grounds, I would argue that debtors, and especially consumer debtors, need as much protection as they can get from overreaching creditors.
Doesn't the judge give them quite a bit of protection under those circumstances?
Yes. The Fibergrate case was specifically premised on the idea that the judge is an impartial third party. However, this case demonstrates the problems with that, because in this case, the trial judge in the first case signed the usurious judgment only after the usury issue was raised by the debtor's counsel. Did the creditor come back with a new valid judgment, which the judge later signed?
I thought, maybe I misread the fact, but I thought the judge had both judgments in front of her and just chose the wrong one.
I don't believe that that was the case. It's a little unclear from the timing of the situation. If she did have it, there was no more than a day, and it very well may have been that that judgment was not in front of her simply because the motion, the new amended motion for judgment would have been filed through the clerk's office and not reached her desk. I don't know whether both judgments were sitting there, but she clearly signed the usurious judgment on one day and then later.
I agree with that, but just from what I picked up from the brief, the other one was already on file at the time she signed it.
That very well may have been the case. I can only surmise that she just simply picked up the first judgment and signed it, because I don't think if she had looked at both judgments that she would have signed the first judgment. But that's pure supposition on my part. But the point that I would make in this case is that Texas has a strong public policy on usury, and without the substantial penalties against creditors doing this kind of thing, and without the strong incentive on the debtor's counsel's part to point this out, the trial judges in these technical areas, especially in computing interest and this type of thing, are really not going to be able to serve as the really independent arbitrator that the Fibergrate case would have liked to have seen. And I just think on public policy grounds that the judge really cannot effectively, as a practical matter, act as the arbitrator. And again, I would really ask the court rhetorically, if you're going to have charging, and the legislature has already decided you're going to have a charging violation, why exclude litigation area from this.
Let me interrupt you here and ask you a question with regards to the issue of charging. Your client signed a promissory note, obligated himself to pay certain funds. Thereafter, refused to pay. He was sued, or the corporation was sued, or the individual was sued, Mr. Crane was sued. A jury found that he owed the money. You did not appeal that judgment, correct?
That is correct.
Thereafter, the attorney drafting the judgment for sense, I think the savings, apparently inserted the wrong amount of interest. What you're proposing here today does not allow for any type of good faith error?
No, I am taking the position, frankly, right out of your concurring opinion that says that either the underlying obligation should be usurious, which I don't agree with, which I'll be happy to talk to you about in a minute, or that there should it should be the result not of a bona fide error. I believe that the protection to the creditor is the bona fide error defense. However, in this case, the association had the opportunity. They pled bona fide error. They had the opportunity to raise evidence of bona fide error, and they absolutely failed to submit any real evidence of a bona fide error in this case. They just simply, the attorney submitted an affidavit that just simply said, I didn't really intend to charge usurious interest. Nothing on facts about that would show that this was some sort of a clerical error. Even the affidavit would seem to say, I meant to do what I did, I just subjectively didn't intend to charge usurious interest. And, you know, you now caught me with my hand in the cookie jar, and I should be allowed to go back in and amend my pleadings. I propose that the bona fide error defense represents the true basis for handling creditors' concerns in this area.
Suppose that the lawyer intended to put what he put in the pleadings, but he just didn't know it was going to be usurious.
Well, I think that in that situation, this court has already said that intent to charge a usurious amount is really not relevant. The question is, if you intended to do what you did, then the legal results or the legal basis is really not relevant for determining whether or not there has been a usury violation. Now, there have been a number of cases in which the courts have struggled with the issue of prejudgment interest, 6% versus 10% and whatever, but I think this court has clarified that issue in several cases right now, and it is pretty clear, and lawyers can very clearly read what the issue is on prejudgment interest and not make excessive demands.
What if there had not been a motion just to propose judgment?
Well, I believe that, of course, the issue of usury can only be from the creditor's creditor's action.
Well, the lawyer for the creditor sends the judge a proposed judgment. Please sign this.
Well, I believe that that would constitute a motion of some type if you just send the judge a judgment and even in the form of a letter that says, please sign that, that in effect is a motion. Certainly
basically,
you can have an oral motion.
Attorney for the creditor, to be very safe, should just better say to the judge, Judge, I want all the interest I'm entitled to. I don't want a penny more. I can't tell you what that is. I don't even want to tell you what my ideas on it.
Oh, I think... always want you to look at the law and give me what you think.
I think a creditor can safely point out that he is making arguments in favor of one side or the other, but that he is clearly not demanding that one versus the other be the case. I think in this particular situation, there were some clear-cut violations that were clearly contrary to the statute, as well as a double dipping on the in the judgment, and there is no evidence that this was a bona fide error defense.
So you can come in with a claim for how interest is to be calculated, which an appellate court thinks is absolutely wrong, and if you tell the trial judge, here's one theory, then that's not a charging.
I would take the position, yes, that if they couched it that in the sense that I'm not sure this is the theory, I certainly think that the litigators should be able in areas where there is a good faith problem with the law to be able to urge, you know, conflicting ideas. And
if there's a good faith problem with the law, why shouldn't that be another bona fide error exception, as opposed to the public policy we've always followed of discouraging sloppy handling on the part of agents by just writing down the biggest amount they can think of, and then coming in later, and if it turns out to be usurious thing, we had no idea it was usurious, we were just throwing some numbers in.
Well, that would certainly be one way if you wanted to carve out an exception in the bona fide error area. That would be one of the areas that I would certainly be looking at if you had a problem with that. The court has not done that.
Cases on that.
There are no cases dealing with that, as a matter of fact.
I guess would say this isn't such a case.
I would say this is definitely not such a case because certainly the judgment and the motion for judgment didn't purport to make arguments. It just simply said, here, we're entitled to this, and the things that they were entitled to, they clearly were not entitled to. There was not even a good faith basis for them making the claim under the law that they were entitled to what they said they were. The only basis that they could get out of this would say that it was a clerical error, and they submitted absolutely no evidence on that.
Any other questions?
When you get back on rebuttal, would you tell me and address this issue for me, what in the motion for judgment makes the request for per diem of $11.80 usurious?
Okay. I'll be happy to address that, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. John Brotherson will present argument for respondents.
May it please the court, Your Honors. I'd like to begin by highlighting some of the important circumstances by which this case came before this court. When Mr. Lapin, the young lawyer in our law firm who prevailed in his jury trial and prepared this proposed judgment, submitted it to the court, he also provided a copy to Mr. O'Connor, the opposing counsel, as he's required to do under the rules. Mr. O'Connor examined that proposed judgment, found what he believed to be an erroneous statement as to post-judgment interest, called that to the attention of the court and to counsel. As a result, Mr. Lapin filed an amended proposed final judgment, which was signed by the court. It's true that the court first erroneously signed the initial judgment, but upon receiving the amended version, she immediately signed that, and that became the final judgment in the case.
Did Mr. Lapin make any attempt to have the first judgment approved as the form before submitting it to the court? Did he, for instance, send it to the opposing counsel several days earlier, or was there space provided for it to be approved as the form?
Your Honor, I simply don't recall. I know that
would make some difference, wouldn't it, if the opposing counsel had either refused to approve it as the form or had done so, and then, you know, later turned out maybe that there was an error in that.
Your Honor, I don't believe it would make a difference. I think Mr. Leffin's obligation was to provide a copy to Mr. O'Connor, essentially to invite his comments to the court if he thought that something in there was in error, which in fact is exactly the way it happened.
It makes it easier for a trial judge if both sides have approved the judgment as to form. Trial judge does not have to sit down and calculate it, for instance.
In hindsight, that, in this case, would have perhaps alleviated this problem, although perhaps Mr. O'Connor still would have declared that a charge was contained.
Or contracting for.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Why wouldn't that just be contracted?
Contracted for?
Usurious interest.
With the opposing counsel? Yeah, it doesn't seem to me like it was a contract, a charge, or a collection of usurious interest. At any rate, Your Honors, the system worked in this case. It functioned exactly as it's intended to do. Final judgments frequently are the product of input from both sides in a lawsuit, and that's why a copy is provided to opposing counsel. The unusual thing in this case is that the opposing counsel, rather than simply calling the mistake to the attention of counsel in the court, claimed that the motion to enter judgment constituted a violation of the usury laws, so that rather than merely asking the court to correct the judgment to be entered against his client, the court was to enter a judgment that would in fact cancel the underlying obligation, which the jury had found was due and owing, in addition to assessing substantial penalties against my client. The Court of Appeals decided this case by drawing a distinction between pleadings which commence a lawsuit and which reflect the underlying facts of a suit, the underlying facts of the debt, on one hand, and motions on the other hand, by which lawyers merely propose that the court take certain action in a lawsuit. I think what the court recognized and was dealing with in drawing this distinction was the fact that usury laws are so clearly not intended to apply to situations like this. Analyzing the legislature's intent in enacting the usury laws shows that the Court of Appeals was correct in this conclusion. Fortunately, the legislature has provided a statement, a declaration of legislative intent with the usury statute, and stated therein that it was enacting the legislation to combat abuses that the legislature found were prevalent in consumer loan transactions, where unscrupulous lenders were engaged in abusive and deceptive acts while dealing with often unsophisticated borrowers. By expressing this concern for the borrower being at the mercy of the lender, the legislature clearly anticipated that usury penalties would apply in the context of a loan transaction, since it was in that context that these abuses that the legislature mentioned would take place. The declaration of intent says nothing about the way lawsuits had been handled. In truth, the abuses referred to in the declaration of legislative intent about unscrupulous lenders having power over unsophisticated borrowers is not even possible in the lawsuit situation. And it's because of the reason that was brought up earlier. Because opposing counsel has a role in monitoring what requests for relief have been made in a lawsuit and responding to those, providing counter-argument, and most importantly, the judge sits as the final arbiter for what relief is appropriate under the circumstances. To consider a motion for judgment as triggering the very severe penalties that are written into the usury statute would do nothing to serve any reasonable purpose of this statute, of the usury statute. And the Court of Appeals was correct in refusing to apply those penalties in this case. None of the cases upon which the plaintiff relies involve anything resembling a motion to enter judgment. They instead all involved usury violations in the way that the underlying debt from the loan transaction was described in the initial pleadings in the case, thus invoking the loan transaction in the lawsuit. This court could follow the lead of the Court of Appeals and draw a distinction along those lines. A request for a judge to take action is simply not a direct charging of usurious interest. Nothing will happen unless the court determines that the relief requested is appropriate under the circumstances. There was some discussion about the good faith or the bona fide error defense is a relief valve for this type of situation. But in truth, Mr. O'Connor has argued in this case in his briefs that a mistake of law is not a defense. This highlights to me the inappropriateness of applying usury in the litigation context.
So you think it should not be usury if it's in a plea either? And that the court is there.
Your Honor, I agree with that. Perhaps the easy route to take would be to agree with the Court of Appeals and state that a clear distinction exists between motions for judgment and an initial pleading in a lawsuit, and certainly usury wouldn't apply to a motion for judgment. But this court has the opportunity now to review the several cases that have stated that pleadings can constitute a charging for usury purposes and can overrule it.
That's your impression of reading the legislative history.
That's correct, Your Honor. I think if we consider the example of prejudgment interest, we see how inappropriate it is and inconsistent with the role of the lawyer as an advocate for his client to apply usury sanctions in the litigation context.
Would it make a difference if both sides have counsel as opposed to if one is unthinking, unsophisticated, pro se?
Perhaps it gets a little closer to the situation that the legislature had in mind where borrowers would be at the mercy of lenders, but no judgment gets to the courts without being reviewed and signed by the court itself. And, you know, if we believe in our judicial system that it's fair, then we have to trust that those judgments will be correct.
In this particular case, and I can't really tell from your brief whether you seriously think there's a usury violation here or not, or whether you think you have an argument that there is a usury violation. But in this case, you would say that the trial judge had a duty to go with a calculator and screen those numbers that have been set in and say, trial judge missed it, that's just a failure of our system.
Well, in this case, we do have opposing counsel who reviewed the proposed judgment and called to the attention of Mr. Lapin and the court that he believed that a usury violation or that an excessive amount of post-judgment interest was being asked for. And immediately the proposed judgment was changed.
Why don't you assume, for the sake of argument, that we were to hold a request for a usurious interest and a motion for judgment is a charge. Looking at this motion to enter final judgment of the title here, and a request for the sum of $44,000 plus a per diem of $11.80, do you concede that that's usurious, or do you contest whether or not that is usurious?
I don't concede that it's usurious, Your Honor, because I believe usury requires a charge. I believe
I'm saying assuming that
that usury does apply.
That's correct. This okay. is a charge. Now, is that amount usurious?
I can't say that I trust my own calculations of this in reviewing this case to present it to the court. I believe that the amount of post-judgment interest requested was excessive. And that's why it was corrected in the second judgment. I do believe that. So I guess my answer to your question is I do concede that assuming usury applies to a motion for entry of judgment, that this would be usurious.
Well, what did the final judgment figure put in per diem? It's identical. Looking at the final judgment here, Exhibit A, the amount in the final judgment of $11.80 per diem is identical. But it says the only difference is from January 13th of 88. Now, did that...
I believe the problem, Your Honor...
What was the problem with the motion?
I believe the problem, Your Honor, was that Mr. Levin used a form of a judgment that contained a paragraph for post-judgment interest. The paragraph that he drafted included a figure for post-judgment interest. He failed to delete the later paragraph that again asked...
That's in a separate pleading. That's in a separate document. It's not in the motion for judgment.
Right. It's not in the motion for judgment. That's correct.
In order for us to find if it's usury, you have to look at not only the motion for judgment plus the judgment itself. Put two documents together.
That's what they're asking to do. Yes,
but if you look at the motion for judgment itself, it does not in and of itself request a usurious charge.
That's correct. The motion itself, that's correct.
Counsel, isn't it true that most lawyers really are not prepared to determine or calculate the amount of interest that is due on a note, either pre or post-judgment? And isn't it true that probably the only safe way to do is to write your client, the bank, or the savings and loan, and say, please tell me the per diem rate that is due, and you need to rely upon them?
I know that's what I would do, Your Honor, because by my candid response earlier, I'm not capable of calculating, but perhaps some lawyers are. But perhaps that would be the safe way.
As long as we're talking about better practice, do not leave it, if you leave it for the trial judge to fill it in with some lawyer, I calculated at the lowest possible rate, simply because it was easy, compounded.
Deck in a way or something.
I'd like to touch just briefly on an alternate ground that exists for affirming this judgment, given that the Court of Appeals correctly found that this suit is barred by the doctrine of res judicata. It's important to note, of course, that the events we're talking about took place not in this suit, but a prior suit. And a judgment was signed and issued in that case declaring that the underlying note was due and payable. Counsel admits that his cause of action, if it exists, for usury violations arose prior to the time that that judgment was signed. He now wants a judgment stating...
I thought his argument is, and the facts show that the charge, if it occurred at all, happened after the jury verdict.
Right, after the jury verdict, but before the judgment was signed. In other words, it occurred, if it occurred, when the motion for signing the judgment was filed.
If it occurred after the jury verdict, how can this be res judicata? The jury could, or the parties could not possibly anticipate this later charge.
Well, actually, Your Honor, this court in language in the Marino versus State Farm case, which was decided last week, speaks to that, admittedly by implication. In that case, the court was addressing when res judicata is a bar. And in that case, the court stated that res judicata applies to claims that arise before the judgment is signed. Could I finish this? Just thought. Before the judgment is signed, the court cited a well-accepted rule that res judicata is not a defense if there's been a material change in facts or law between the first judgment and the second suit. Not from the verdict to the second suit, but between the first judgment and second suit. The clear implication is that while a cause of action arising after judgment is not barred by res judicata, a cause of action arising before judgment is barred. And with reference to whether Mr. O'Connor could have filed could have successfully obtained leave to file a trial amendment, a post-verdict amendment, I'd call this court's attention to the, I believe it's Greenhall versus Service Lloyds case, which was decided on April 10th, which speaks to that point.
Do you concede that in this context, the charge, if there was one, was for the use, forbearance, or detention of money?
I'd say no, Your Honor, because the judgment hadn't been paid. Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors, in answer to that last question, I think clearly that it would be a use forbearance or detention of money because there clearly was an underlying debtor-creditor relationship.
What if there had not been?
What?
What if there had not been?
Then I don't think there would be a basis for usury.
If a plaintiff goes and sues for personal injuries and gets a jury verdict of $1,000 and asks for judgment $1,000 plus 25% interest from the date of injury, then that's not usurious.
Until there is a debt, and until I think the judge enters a judgment, there is not a debt in a tort action. And I think there can be a distinction drawn between cases in which there are lawsuits on notes or other debts and those cases in which you're suing under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act or you're suing on a tort violation. You've got to have a use forbearance or detention of money before you can get into the usury context.
So if I buy a car for $1,000 and I say it's only worth $6,000 and I sue under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act for the difference, and when I get a verdict favorable to me, I ask for too much interest, that would not be a serious charge.
I don't think so. The only exception I can say, which of course when I say use forbearance or detention of money, of course we have a time price doctrine in Texas, and if I'm assuming that if we get into that area, you might have a usury context there because the legislature regulates not only interest, but also the time price differential on credit sales. But outside of those two areas, I don't believe you could have this problem. If you had an unliquidated claim and there was not a debtor-creditor relationship before the judgment. Now, back to the computation of the interest. I believe in this particular case, the $11.80 per diem would eventually result in a usurious rate simply because it is based upon a 360-day calculation. And by compounding eventually by itself, that is going to result in a usurious interest rate, as well as at the end of the judgment where he asks for 10% on the entire amount of the judgment compounded daily.
But your point is that in your theory of the case is that there was a charge of usurious interest in the motion for judgment.
That is correct.
Now you're saying, well, it's not a motion for judgment. It's a motion for judgment in addition to the judgment.
Well, I think the motion for judgment incorporates the judgment. When you ask the court to enter a judgment, you incorporate what you are proposing the judge to enter as part of your motion. This is what I'm asking for. This is what I'm claiming. And if you were to just simply write a letter to the court and say, enclosed is a judgment which I request this court to enter, and attached is the judgment, I would say the letter constitutes the motion and incorporates the underlying judgment, and that's where the charging violation occurs. It's not the judge signing the judgment, but the creditor making the motion for the judgment.
There's nothing in the motion to enter final judgment in and of itself that requires a usurious charge of interest.
I just am not prepared to answer that. I have not looked at that because I have always read the motion and the judgment together as being one document. I believe that the whole thing constitutes the motion. So,
one's entitled motion, the other one's entitled final judgment. The motion for judgment doesn't say, in addition to the $11.80 per diem,
you're not
for judgment interest.
Right.
Would be usurious. I mean, you're there.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
$11.80 per day.
That is correct. You have to look at the judgment.
In order to hold for you, we would have to read the motion for judgment in addition to the judgment itself.
together to get us a usurious charge.
The proposed judgment.
Yeah, the proposed judgment, not the one.
The proposed judgment, that is correct.
Well, there were two proposed judgments, the first judgment that was signed.
That's correct. The one that was submitted along with it. And I'm saying that the computations, the 1180 per day, which is based on a 360-day basis, plus the 10% compounded daily, would, even if you didn't take the double dipping, just the compounding daily and the 360-day computation will eventually result in usurious interest. You combine them both together, and you've got an immediate usury problem. May I make one comment about the res judicata defense?
Very quickly.
I would say that you have to have the right opportunity to try to come first court before you can be barred by res judicata. This case, the usury counterclaim was not a compulsory counterclaim under 97A, and because that requires that you have to bring as a compulsory counterclaim anything that you had at the time of the pleadings, and all the pleadings had been in place.
Thank you, Heather.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. That concludes the argument in the case.